Ah, great. Okay. So, yeah, hello and welcome. My name is Vince Cullen. Thank you for joining me today, and thank you to everyone at Sanger Live for having me again. It really is a pleasure to be here. Life is naturally difficult and disappointing. All living creatures are programmed to seek security and safety. As human beings, we also seek certainty. And these things are hard to find in the first place, and impermanent and subject to change in the second place. We are prone to live life as unconscious prisoners of fear. Fear of this world and of the next world. Fear of sickness and of death. Fear of insecurity and of being defenseless. Fear of the unknown and of the unexpected. Fear of what is different and fear of failure. In short, fear of life itself. In today's talk, I hope to explore some links between fear and craving, and touch on the critical difference between getting ahead and getting along on the Buddhist path. I want to offer a perspective on life's basic necessities and how the craving for safety, the craving for security, and the craving for certainty can lead to a life of isolation, a life of fear, and a life of confusion. However, I must say that Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor and Stoic philosopher, once said, "Everything we hear is an opinion and not a fact, and everything we see is a perspective and not the truth." After our meditation today, I would like to share with you some of my opinions and perspectives about cabbages and condoms, about fish floundering around in puddles, and about getting along rather than getting ahead. And as Marcus Aurelius rightly says, these are only my opinions and perspectives. They're not necessarily facts or the truth. But I do hope that today's session will give you an alternative view on things, on how things might be in your own world. But first, we're going to sit together for about 30 minutes and to practice mindfulness and to cultivate wise-heartedness in a guided meditation that's in two parts. Firstly, we'll use mindfulness to calm the breath, to relax the body, and to quiet the mind as best as we are able. And then we'll practice and explore and cultivate, as best as we are able, an attitude of wise-heartedness, as it might manifest in our lives, particularly in response to difficult situations, in response to difficult times, and in response to the ordinary and the mundane of everyday existence. Either part of this guided meditation could be a standalone practice, but I'm offering them together today, particularly aimed at those people who are new to meditation. And for those people who are not new to meditation and perhaps have an aversion to guided meditations, well, please do feel free to tune out for the next half an hour. Take an upright, dignified posture. A posture as best you can in whatever environment you currently find yourself. Your posture might represent the alertness of your heart's desire to awaken. That is, your heart's noble desire to move away from avoidable stress and suffering. Your heart's noble desire to move away from avoidable stress and suffering. To end avoidable stress and suffering. Importantly, perhaps even critically, this movement away from stress and suffering should not be driven by aversion. Aversion to the disappointments and difficulties of life. But this moment might be guided by loving kindness and grounded in compassion for this experience of being human. If it's comfortable for you, you might let your eyes gently close. We can begin our meditation today by taking a very full, very deep breath in. And a very long, slow breath out, feeling the breath in the whole body as we do so. And again, a very full, very deep breath in. And a very long, slow, deliberate breath out, noticing our physical posture, particularly where our body connects with the ground or in our seat, or where our legs and feet touch the floor. We might bring to mind the sense of being grounded and supported, sitting here and now together with fellow travellers on the path to liberation. You might now allow your breath just to settle down quite naturally. Allow your face to be soft and let your jaw relax. I recommend having a small smile on your face, real or imagined. Let your shoulders drop back quite naturally to open up the heart area. Let your arms and your hands rest easily in your lap or on your thighs. The Buddha's instructions for the full awareness of breathing say that we should breathe in with mindfulness and we should breathe out with mindfulness. So if it's helpful for you, you might silently note to yourself, breathing in, I'm fully aware that I'm breathing in. And breathing out, I'm fully aware that I'm breathing out. Whether you focus your awareness of the breath at the nostrils, the chest, the belly, or the whole body is immaterial. What matters is that you notice the breath. So place your attention wherever it works for you. After a little while, when we're a little bit further into our meditation, we might let go of any verbal commentary. And just with full awareness, we might simply notice in, out. Almost inevitably, it won't be long before you notice that your mind has wandered away from your breath. And that's just what the mind naturally wants to do. When you notice this, just smile. Make a friendly, gentle, silent, non-judgmental note of not breath. And then return your full awareness to this wonderful life-giving process of breathing. As you listen to my voice, you might maintain an ongoing awareness, a mindfulness, if you will, of each in-breath and each out-breath. We use mindfulness in our meditation practice to remember to stay with or to remember to come back to our meditation object. In this case, the experience of breathing in and the experience of breathing out. As well as remembering to remember to stay with or to return to the embodied experience of breathing, mindfulness also encompasses the wider faculty and intention to remember something specific or to keep something in mind or not to forget something. This is particularly the case when that something that is being remembered is something that you've heard or read or perhaps had a personal realization of. But whatever the reason, whatever the origin or the something that is being recalled or kept in mind, it will be specifically something that is helpful, skillful, and wholesome. Remembering, as it were, that mindfulness is always in the service of ending or reducing suffering. In one of the talks in the Pali Canon, the Buddha asked the question, "And what is the power of mindfulness?" And then, as was so often his teaching style, he answers the question himself. He says, "It's when a practitioner is mindful, they have the utmost mindfulness and alertness and can remember and recall what was said and done long ago. This is called the power of mindfulness." Personally, for me, one of the most important and liberating somethings that I remember and recall, both on and off the meditation cushion, is the first line from verse number 6 of the Dhammapada. It simply says, "There are those who do not realize that one day we must all die." So I am, or I try to be, ever mindful. I remember to remember that my life consists of a limited number of breaths. Each breath that I take on or off the cushion is one less breath before I take my final breath. In 12-step traditions, there's an emphasis on living life one day at a time. But in Dharma traditions, the emphasis is on living life one breath at a time. Whether on or off the cushion, we're invited to bring a friendly, affectionate interest to each and every breath. We're also invited to bring a friendly, affectionate attitude to each and every breath. With a mindful interest and a mindful attitude to each and every breath, we're encouraged to befriend our practice. We're encouraged to befriend ourselves. Being at home with our breath cultivates serenity in the sense of being mentally untroubled. Being at ease with our breath cultivates calm, in the sense of being physically at ease. A simple awareness of our breath, either on or perhaps more importantly off the cushion, can cultivate joy in the sense of both physical and mental pleasure. There is no better place or time to practice mindfulness than right here, right now. We can learn to relax into this moment, this only moment, where nothing is lacking or wanting. And we do not have to be at war with our present moment experience. Breathing in, I intentionally calm my body. And breathing out, I intentionally experience pleasure. There's nothing else to do. There's nowhere else to go. And there's no one special to be. This is calm and pleasant abiding in the here and now. Breathing in, I intentionally calm my body. And breathing out, I can intentionally experience pleasure. For the second part of our meditation, it can be helpful to bring our awareness to our chest so that we might imagine that we're breathing in and breathing out through our heart center. Wherever it is in your chest that you imagine your heart to be, we focus our attention there, specifically as we breathe in and as we breathe out through that place. Feel free to place your hand on your heart just for a breath or two, to amplify the embodied experience of this practice. We can continue today's meditation by taking a very full, very deep breath in through the heart, and a long, slow breath out through the heart. And again, a very full, very deep breath in through the heart. And a very long, slow, deliberate breath out through the heart area. Having already spent time cultivating calm and pleasant abiding, you're now invited to cultivate wise-heartedness. We can do this by reciting one or some or even all of the following aspirations, just like a silent whisper at the back of our mind. May I have stillness in the midst of chaos. May I be at ease in the midst of discomfort. May I be safe and well in the midst of uncertainty. May I live with kindness in the midst of all that is difficult. May I find joy in the midst of the ordinary and the mundane. Like our earlier serenity breath meditation, we can bring an affectionate curiosity and a friendly attitude to each recited phrase. May I have stillness in the midst of chaos. Without judgment, but with some discernment, you might investigate this phrase. Do you currently have any sort of chaos in your life? What does that chaos look like? What is needed or helps to bring stillness to chaos? Would it be for our benefit and welfare if we could remember to hold this aspiration in our heart? May I be at ease in the midst of discomfort? Are you currently experiencing mental or physical discomfort? What does this discomfort feel like? What does it need, or is it even possible to bring ease to discomfort? Would it be for our benefit and welfare if we could remember to hold this aspiration in our heart? May I be safe and well in the midst of uncertainty? If there is uncertainty in your life, how does it manifest? What does uncertainty look like? What does it feel like? Can you still be safe and well alongside the experience of uncertainty? Would it be for our benefit and welfare if we could remember to hold this aspiration in our heart? May I live with kindness, even in the midst of all that is difficult. The mind naturally inclines towards the negative. Is it possible to befriend the difficult and the disappointing? Can you live with kindness in these situations? And would it be for our benefit and welfare if we could remember to hold this aspiration in our heart? May I find joy in the ordinary and the mundane. We are naturally inclined towards sensual pleasure, novelty, stimulation, and excitement. Sometimes we simply crave to be anywhere else but here. Is it possible to be content with this present moment experience, where nothing needs to be added and nothing needs to be taken away? If we abandon our preferences and aversions, if we let go of our likes and dislikes and drop our wants and don't wants, then what is it that's left? Would it be for our benefit and welfare if we could remember to hold this aspiration in our hearts? May I have stillness in the midst of chaos. May I be at ease in the midst of discomfort. May I be safe and well in the midst of uncertainty. May I live with kindness, even in the midst of all that is difficult. May I find joy in the midst of the ordinary and the mundane. May I have stillness. May I be at ease. May I be safe and well. May I live with kindness. May I find joy. In the sense of mindfulness being remembering to remember, we might recall the idea that the only wise response to any situation, to any experience, is a response of the wise heart. Through the application of joy and appreciation, friendliness and kindness, generosity and compassion, understanding and acceptance, we might arrive one day at the perfect, unshakable, liberated heart. A heart that is free from craving, free from aversion, and free from fear and free from confusion. May I have stillness. May I be at ease. May I be safe and well. May I live with kindness. May I find joy. The phrases for wise-heartedness bhavana were greatly influenced and inspired by the teachings of Christina Feldman, to whom and for which I'm eternally grateful. My talk today will be a gentle, meandering exploration of life's basic necessities, cabbages and condoms, as it were, and how our craving for safety, our craving for security, and our craving for certainty can lead to a life filled to a greater or lesser degree with fear and confusion. But as the Buddha said, and as modern psychology and neuroscience teach us, it doesn't have to be that way. I gave a condensed version of this talk to a different online audience in July this year, but it was an unmitigated technical disaster, even though I had more than a good internet connection. The conference software on this laptop refused to recognize such a good connection and repeatedly and frustratingly for everyone kept disconnecting. I'm hoping for today at least that lightning doesn't strike twice in the same place. In the interests of transparency, I feel I should disclose my ever-changing relationship to the Dharma. Peter Harvey, the Pali scholar, translates the word Dharma as the basic pattern of things. And increasingly, I find myself exploring this basic pattern of things, or we might say the way things really are, not just through the early Pali texts of the Theravada Buddhist tradition, but through modern psychologies and neurosciences, and particularly focusing on the nature of relationships, the nature of self, and the nature of consciousness. This wider aspect of Dharma, beyond that of the traditional Buddha Dharma, as the basic pattern of things, is reflected in today's talk, which I hope you will find both interesting and maybe a little challenging. I don't know. That's up to you to decide. Anyway, to begin, by way of an introduction, you may be aware that I have been and I continue to be associated with Wat Tham Prabok Buddhist Temple in central Thailand. This famous or even infamous monastery, nicknamed the Vomiting Temple, that has been offering a free herbal detox program to Thais and to foreigners alike since 1959. I first visited Wat Tham Prabok nearly 23 years ago in November 1998. And I was fortunate enough at that time to meet the first abbot of the monastery, a very kind monk named Lompor Chamrun Panchand. He was an ex-policeman who left the Bangkok drug squad in 1953 and became a wandering monk, a Tudong monk. And for 5 years, along with a small group of male and female monks that included his aunt, who was known as Lompor Yai, and his younger brother, the monk Pra Charon, he walked all over the west, north, northeast of Thailand and into Cambodia and Laos. This small group of wandering monastics finally settled down and established the Wat Thamprabot Monastery in response to Thailand's chronic opium epidemic in the mid-1950s. Sadly, Nompor Chamrun passed away in early 1999, just a few months after my first visit. I continued to visit the monastery on a number of occasions around that time, including accompanying addicts from the UK for detox treatment. I don't escort addicts anymore. That's not necessary. But I still like to visit the temple at least once a year. However, as you might imagine, due to the COVID pandemic, I didn't get there this year. I didn't get there last year. But that's just how things are right now. And by applying a little bit of equanimity and creative acceptance, as it were, I'm not going to suffer for my preferences. When the next opportunity arises and it's safe to do so, I'm sure that I'll be back at Wat Thamprabok, catching up with the monks and nuns that I've known for more than 20 years and sharing some Dharma and recovery advice with the non-Thai detoxees. When I'm at the monastery, I like to take the opportunity each afternoon to visit the herbal steam baths, where monks, nuns and lay people spend a lot of time sipping herbal tea and popping in and out of the herbal sauna. The herbal tea that is drunk is actually a byproduct from when the monks brew the notorious emetic detox medicine. But the tea is not unpleasant to taste, nor does it make you vomit. Having said that, I will normally, at least once during any visit, take the herbal emetic remedy as a sort of cleansing ritual and social connection. I'm a creature of habit, and in between enjoying the herbal steam bath in the afternoon and before taking the emetic vomiting potion in the evening, I take the opportunity to join the monks and nuns at evening chanting. Just as an aside, having previously twice taken temporary ordination at the temple, I have my own chanting book, which is not normally the case for lay people. There are a total of 72 chants in the Thamprabok chanting book that were all composed by Lumpur Yai, the abbot's aunt who was a bhikkhuni and who actually founded the monastery along with her two nephews, Pra Chamrun, who, I'd met before his untimely death, and his younger brother, Pra Charon, who later became the abbot. The 72 chants, just like everything else about Wat Thamprabok, are unique and are not to be found anywhere else in Thailand, let alone the rest of the world. Anyway, the chanting takes place in a building known as the Magsaysay Sala, or the Magsaysay Hall, which was built with the prize money that the first abbot, Nompor Chamrun, was awarded in 1975, when he won the Ramon Magsaysay Award for the monastery's contribution to universal healthcare, in that they were providing a drug detox and rehab program that was, and still is to this day, freely available to all. The Magsaysay Award is Asia's equivalent of the Nobel Prize. This award is named after the famous Philippines president, Ramon Magsaysay, and is known formally as the Ramon Magsaysay Award. Now, this is perhaps a very loose link to a wonderful man known very affectionately in Thailand as Mr. Condom, a very enterprising and socially engaged man named Michai Viruwacha, who in 1994, after 20 years of public service, was also awarded the Ramon Magsaysay Award for his many contributions to social development and the improvement of people's quality of life. Michai was specifically recognised for his projects that focused on inclusive education, for the creation of an NGO known as the PDA to promote social enterprise and rural livelihood. The award was also for his work in social justice and peace building. And lastly, and maybe most importantly, the award was for his contribution again to universal healthcare, but this time focused on sex education and family planning and for leading Thailand's battle against HIV/AIDS. His efforts are said to have prevented more than 7 million unnecessary deaths in Thailand. As I said, Michai is known as Mr. Condom, and he even has an entry in Thai dictionaries because condoms in Thailand and they are colloquially known as Mechais. Since 1974, Mechai has been creating and running innovative family planning and poverty reduction programs throughout Southeast Asia. When Mechai and a band of volunteers first started distributing condoms to encourage family planning, he said that you can go to any shop around Thailand and you'll always find cabbages. Condoms, he reasoned, should be just like cabbages, which are ubiquitous and accessible to everyone. To raise funds and to promote family planning and HIV/AIDS awareness, Mechai opened a small vegetable stand on the PDA office premises, where vegetables, along with lace underwear, T-shirts, keychains, condoms, oral contraceptives, were all sold to local residents. Mechai called this shop Cabbages and Condoms, a very catchy and unconventional name that never failed to elicit chuckles from passers-by and to draw in the curious to the shop. Now, this talk isn't an advert for Cabbages and Condoms, but it has become a chain of respected restaurants across Thailand, and there are even a couple of branches in the UK. The restaurant's motto is, "Our food is guaranteed not to make you pregnant." All the profits from Cabbages and Condoms restaurants in Thailand support the PDA's work and its ongoing programs in primary health, in education, in HIV/AIDS assistance, in rural development, in helping the environment and water conservation, and latterly tackling the impact of climate change. The name Cabbages and Condoms and the assertion by Mechai that condoms should not be seen as taboo, but as a necessity, got me thinking about life's basic drives, about life's basic imperatives. In short, Cabbages and Condoms got me thinking about food and sex and their importance to the experience of being human. These two primary drives that universally define what it is to be human, or any living animal for that matter, the imperative to sustain life and to produce offspring. Well, that requires food and sex in some form or another, at the very, very least. But it's not just our basic search for nourishment and procreation. More crucially, our basic human drive, above all others, is survival at any cost. Dead people don't have offspring. As a slight aside here, I'd like to introduce you to a wonderful series of short films by Professor Philip Hanlon and the After Now Project of Glasgow University from 10 years ago or so. The After Now Project was tracing the development of society's current situation, where medical conditions such as obesity, depression, addictions, loss of well-being were reaching disturbing and unmanageable levels. And sadly, things haven't got much better in the interceding 10 years since these videos were published. However, in one of the short videos, Professor Hanlon says, "People describe us as basically being obesogenic organisms. If you think back to the fact that most of our ancestors lived in hunter-gatherer communities, and there, if you imagine, the kill has been done, the antelope is cooking on the fire, and one of your ancestors says, 'No thanks, I'll just have berries tonight.' Well, that man died. He didn't become your great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. And alternatively, the one who came back from the hunt and said, 'I'm off for a jog tonight,' well, he died too. The ones that sat and conserved it and conserved their energy, the ones that gobbled the food greedily, they're the ones who survived to be our ancestors. So we're hardwired to eat when we can and to rest at every opportunity." I won't go into the After Now Project in any more detail, but only to say that disappointingly, it didn't gain enough traction. And other than to say that project falls into the benefit for all category of intentions, with community health and well-being being its primary objective. But I will post a link for you, and I invite you to explore the After Now Project, the book and the videos for yourself. Also, from an evolutionary perspective, we seek places of safety and security, and we seek certainty. We don't like unexpected surprises. This drive to survive can manifest and influence our behaviours and relationships in a couple of significantly different ways. the inclination to get ahead at any cost, or the inclination to get along for the mutual benefit of all. Over the course of human history and evolution, the pendulum between these attitudes has swung both ways. Thousands of years ago, as hunter-gatherers, we had to work together as a team in order to overcome and survive. Tom Oliver, professor of applied ecology at the University of Reading in the UK, writes, "In pre-modern times, it made sense to be fearful of other groups. They might be violent, steal our resources, or introduce new diseases that we are not adapted to. Conversely, it was beneficial to trust those who look similar to us. They are more likely to be related. And when we can help these kin, our own genes are more likely to be passed to future generations. Beyond such genetic influences, our human culture strongly influences our attitudes and behavior, modifying innate human drives, either suppressing them or encouraging them further. Whether we tolerate and trust someone or fear and reject them depends a lot on this culture." Lisa Feldman Barrett, the distinguished professor of psychology at Northeastern University, has written two wonderful books that I can highly recommend. The first is called How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. And the other is slightly easier to read. And it's called 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. Both books offer insights into why much of our lives are simply not personal, but the construction of the brain to fulfill the imperative to survive and to reproduce. To paraphrase some of the current insights of psychology and neuroscience, the brain is not a thinking machine. It is a prediction machine whose primary purpose is to keep us alive, well and fit for reproduction, so that we can pass our genes on to the next generation. The brain predicts the body's need for the use of water, salt, glucose, etc. The brain predicts and decides whether we should act or not act, whether we should use biological resources or save them, whether we should run away, stand and fight, or just freeze. We are conditioned to seek safety. We are averse to danger. The brain wants to avoid surprises, almost literally to predict the future, to anticipate what might happen next. This causes us to crave certainty and dislike unexpected surprises. From the perspective of survival at any cost, the brain's predictions beat physical reactions. We are conditioned to fear. The brain's predictions, conditioned by or constructed from past experience, repeat what works and avoids what doesn't work. Even single-cell organisms do this. In short, the brain's primary purpose is not to think, but to keep us alive at any cost, mostly without us even being aware of that imperative. Our evolutionary and cultural heritages lead to development of what might be considered as different types of mind. There are cultures that value getting ahead. They prioritize the individual over the group. And there are cultures that value getting along, prioritizing the group over the individual. It's worth looking at our own actions from these perspectives, then seeing how these unconscious imperatives drive our own and other people's views and opinions and words and actions. Some personal, social, and cultural mindsets are inclined towards getting ahead in direct opposition to getting along. For example, nationalism, exceptionalism, religious traditions, political parties, sports teams, and so on, grasping and clinging to the view, attitude, and behavior of getting ahead as a source of safety, refuge, certainty, solace, redemption, or success. Generally speaking, getting ahead is often at the expense of other people and even at the expense of other species. There is a set of verses called the Atta-Kavaga, or the Chapter of Eights, in the Buddhist Pali Canon. The Atta-Kavaga is regarded as one of the earliest texts in that collection. In one particular poem called Taking Up Arms, the Buddha describes his grief and his fear at seeing people's hostility towards each other People's hostility, contending for resources, and the lack of security in the world. Now, I find these words attributed to the Buddha absolutely striking, particularly the first five verses of this poem, which I've paraphrased as follows. Fear is born assuming violence. See how the people fight. I'll tell you how I'm deeply moved. I'll tell you how I experience terror. Seeing people floundering like fish in small puddles, competing with one another. As I saw this, fear came into me. The world is everywhere insecure. Every direction is in turmoil. Desiring an abode for myself, I did not find one uninhabited. Seeing nothing in the end but competition, I felt discontent. And then I saw an arrow here, so very hard to see, embedded in the heart. It's only when one pierced by this arrow that one runs in all directions. So if the arrow is taken out, one does not run. One settles down. These verses posed a question for me. What is the wise response to chaos in the world? What is this arrow in the heart? And how do I remove it? As a slight aside, but related, the Prophet Muhammad said, in the body there is a morsel of flesh, which if it be sound, all the body is sound, and which if it be diseased, all the body is diseased. This part of the body is the heart. With the universality of our craving for safety and certainty in mind, I've been intrigued recently by the Buddha's four summaries, as recounted by the monk Ratapala in the Ratapala Sutta in the middle-length discourses of the early Pali text. I'm surprised that these four summaries don't get more attention. They go something like this. The world is unstable, and I can be swept away at any moment. The world has no shelter, no protector, no savior. The world has no owner. I must leave everything behind. The world is lacking, wanting, insatiable, leaving me the slave of craving. For me personally, these four summaries of human existence rank alongside and in some ways are more powerful than the Four Noble Truths. Rather like Meechai Wiriwacha dispelling the taboo surrounding condoms and sex, the four summaries confront us with the realities of the fragility and fleeting nature of life. I don't find the four summaries nihilistic or depressing, quite the opposite, in fact. They state what life is really like, not how I imagine it to be or I want it to be. Rather like coming across the Four Noble Truths for the first time, stumbling upon the four summaries was a little shocking, but also very liberating. Just like verse number 6 from the Dhammapada that I mentioned in our meditation. There are those who do not realize that one day we all must die. Much of our behavior is impersonal, driven by unconscious imperatives, such as the hunger for food and sex and other sensual desires, such as the search for security and certainty, such as the search for security and certainty that altogether manifest as the arrow in the heart, the arrow that makes us flounder around like fish in small puddles and has us running about in all directions. This arrow, or arrows of greed, hatred and delusion. In the Buddha's famous talk to the Kalamas, he asked them to investigate greed, hatred and delusion. He asked the Kalamas, do these mind states lead to harm and suffering, or do they lead to welfare and benefit? Then he asked the Kalamas, do the mind states that are free of greed, free of hatred and free of delusion lead to harm and suffering, or do they lead to your welfare and happiness? Then the Buddha goes on, when you know for yourself that these qualities are skillful, these qualities are blameless, these qualities are praised by the wise, these qualities are, when adopted and carried out, lead to welfare and happiness. then you should dwell there. Living with a heart full of love, a heart full of compassion, a heart full of rejoicing, and a heart full of equanimity in every direction, above, below, across, everywhere, all around. Spreading a heart full of love, a heart full of compassion, a heart full of rejoice, and a heart full of equanimity to the whole world, abundant, expansive, limitless, free of hostility and ill will. Of course, what the Buddha is talking about here is the practice of the Brahma Viharas, the cultivation of universal friendliness, of compassion, of joy, gladness, of equanimity. A practice that is intended to progressively break down and to remove the perceived barriers between ourselves and others. Perhaps a better example of this instruction are the Buddha's words on the mindfulness that is universal friendliness or loving kindness, where in the Metta Sutta, he asks us to cultivate friendliness to all living beings, regardless of whether they're weak or powerful, regardless of whether they look like us or they look different to us, regardless of whether they are local people we know or foreigners from distant lands. May all beings everywhere, without exception, be happy. We are encouraged to cultivate this mindfulness that is beyond hatred and beyond aversion. Increasingly, I see the core foundational underlying goal of traditional Buddhist practice, particularly through the practice of mindfulness, is to get along, and very, very specifically, not to get ahead, which is always driven by craving, aversion, and confusion, and usually at the expense of someone or something else. The moral and ethical inclination of the Buddha's teachings are exemplified in the five universal precepts that are inherently for the benefit and welfare of the individual and of the community. As the Buddha says, now there are these five gifts, five great gifts, original, long-standing, traditional, ancient, unadulterated from the beginning. They're not open to suspicion, will never be open to suspicion, and are unfaulted by knowledgeable contemplatives and Brahmins. Now, the Buddha spoke these words in a talk called the Reward Sutta more than 2,500 years ago, clearly making the point that these suggestions for a peaceful life were already original and long-standing. They were already ancient and traditional. So these precepts shouldn't be considered Buddhist, or more correctly, they should be recognized as being universal. As the Buddha says, not open to suspicion and irrefutable by intelligent people. A simple rendering of these valuable guidelines might read, it's not a good idea to kill people. It's not a good idea to take what doesn't belong to you. It's not a good idea to be sexually irresponsible. It's not a good idea to lie to people. And it's not a good idea to take intoxicants that confuse the mind. What we might now call basic human rights are both explicit and implicit in the practice of these five simple suggestions. Everyone has the right to physical safety. Everyone has the right to their property being respected. Everyone has the right to have their sexual boundaries respected. Everyone has a right to be spoken to truthfully, and everyone has a right to a life free of intoxicants. Gautama's poetic realization that we are like fish floundering around in ever-shrinking puddles of water, or his four summaries of the fragility of human existence, might seem shocking at first. But as he realized, we don't have to live in fear. We can change our subconscious habitual reaction. We can remove the arrow of greed and hatred and delusion, and heal our heart. The only wise response to any situation or experience is a response of the healthy heart, a heart free from craving, a heart free from aversion and free from confusion, a heart that can be cultivated through such practices as the Brahma Viharas, where we deliberately break down the barriers between self and other. We can live life from a wise perspective and intentionality of getting along, letting go of any misdirected search for safety, security, and certainty, which in many ways is a waste of time and energy. From a very personal perspective, which is not necessarily a fact or the truth, my only real refuge is in the uncertainty of my life or the certainty of my death. That is why I value each and every breath, making uncertainty my home. Not in the sense of uncertainty as fear, But uncertainty is transforming into possibilities and potentiality for a full experience of life. Giving up the getting ahead mind, giving up the futile search for safety and the drive to survive at any cost, is not the end of the world, but it is the end of fear and conflict, both internal and external. Perhaps when we see the truth of the Dharma as the basic pattern of things, either through modern psychology and neuroscience or through ancient Buddhist Dharma, we might evolve to the point we don't need to live in a puddle and fight for survival anymore. As the Buddha says, and so this spiritual life is not lived for the sake of possessions, honor, and popularity, or for accomplishment in ethics, or for accomplishment in concentration, or for knowledge and vision. Rather, the goal, the core, and the final end of the spiritual life is the perfect, unshakable freedom of the heart. Like the free detox program offered at Wat Tantra Bok and Meechai Viruwachya's many social improvement projects through the PDA, we might individually cultivate an attitude of heart that supports the goal of getting along for the benefit of all. And maybe then we can all flourish in this world fearlessly. And that's my talk for this evening. I'll just mention again this idea of dana, of generosity, of supporting these teachings. And whatever you might be able to pass on, whatever you might be able to contribute, helps these teachings to spread further. It helps support the work of Sangha Live, and it helps to support my continued teaching and my continued studies as well. I continue to study under teachers, and in my own way, I pass on the dana. I offer dana myself. So now it's that time of our session where we're open for questions and answers. So there's an ask a question box at the bottom of your screen, sort of in the middle, near the bottom of your screen, is ask a question box. We would normally ask you to come on screen and ask your question, but my connection is so fragile tonight that we're not going to risk doing anything that might cause a loss of connection. So feel free to ask a question, to type it into the box. All comments, questions, and complaints are welcome. And if people are interested, probably on the Hungry Ghost website, Hungry Ghost Retreats website, I'll post a transcript of this talk, or as close to as I presented it. And I'll also include all the links to the books and to the videos and to all the sutta references I made as well. Thank you, Kamal. I won't chance it, but I wonder if someone could check that link and make sure it works. And Caroline might just comment, if I posted an embedded hyperlink into the chat, would that come through? I'll try one anyway to see if it. Now, I can't post all the links into the chat box because it says it doesn't like it. But I will put the transcript of this talk or as close as I can make it, and all the links to the various sutras and books on the Hungry Ghost website. And I've just posted a link to the downloads page on the Fifth Precept website, which has the phrases for the wise-heartedness meditation there, and lots of other nice stuff to download as well. Okay, from Marita, I do metta when traveling on the subway. It's wonderful. Mostly I get off loving each and every one on the train. There are those easily lovable, and I start with those and continue until I recognize everyone. That's wonderful, Marita. These practices aren't intended just for on the cushion. That their real value is taking them out onto the street, taking them out onto the subway. So thank you for sharing that. And from Craig, hello, would you perhaps discuss how competition, generally speaking, in our society is related to human nature? Thank you so much. The word competition perhaps isn't right, Craig. It's more about this idea of getting ahead, of which stems back to you know, early man and wandering across the savannah in tribes, and sometimes it was important to protect your family, your tribe, your resources, and sometimes it was more desirable or more helpful to get along and to work with others, and I think the sort of history goes, or the ecology of it goes, that once we started to settle down and grow our own food and look after animals, we started to have more children. We're well fed, and more of our children survived, and we started to then to congregate around the family as a unit, Which then, introduced that sense of competition. Well, I've got, I'm looking after my resources for my family and not the rest of the tribe. So I wish I could answer your question a bit more, with a bit more clarity, Craig, but I can't, other than to say that perhaps, the idea of competition has been exploited by... Well, a competition has certainly, I hadn't thought about this before. I mean, competition has certainly helped the development, of mankind. There is a place for healthy competition, but that's not always what we're faced with. Craig, I can't say much more than that because it isn't an angle I've looked at, that idea of the balancing, healthy competition. I'm still I'm not happy with the word, and the competition which is at the expense of other people and other species and resources. A question from Marta says, do you think, based on your knowledge, that the Buddha was a traumatized child? And are you planning on opening face-to-face retreats this year in Ireland? Thank you. Well, first of all, a very long, sad, disappointing, depressing story around retreats in Ireland. And in the sense of there certainly won't be any retreats at Nallagiri House in Ireland, whether I do retreats elsewhere in Ireland remains to be seen. There's certainly a retreat in Devon in England for July next year, and hopefully more will start to go in the diary as we approach 2022. Your question about do you think, based on your knowledge, that the Buddha was a traumatized child? Well, I mean, of course, the obvious answer is I don't know, because I don't know the Buddha. However, having read some, there are thousands and thousands of the Buddha's talks recorded, but having read some of his talks, reading between the lines, I do see the Buddha as a traumatized child. I do see him being a huge disappointment in people and things that he says, why do I place my happiness in people and things that are impermanent? Why do I place my happiness in people and things that just bring suffering? But what I particularly like is that poem, Taking Up Arms poem, where the Buddha, if anything, describes his reasons for leaving home and trying to find liberation, trying to find a way of life that doesn't include floundering around in puddles, this constant competition and fighting between people. So yes, Martha, I do see the Buddha as a traumatized child, but then I see everyone as traumatized children. This life, the first noble truth, that life is difficult, life is disappointing, life's unfair, and then you die. So the trauma of being a child and developing a healthy sense of self, not that there's no self, but we can have a healthy sense of this conglomerate of things, thoughts and memories and perceptions and inclinations that make up myself. Developing a healthy sense of self is very difficult. But hopefully these teachings, the Buddhist teachings, and the current and unfolding teachings of psychology and neuroscience about how we literally construct our world in our heads. Another book I can highly recommend is by Anil Seth, the neuroscientist Anil Seth of Sussex University, a book called Being You. And he describes how our world, our experience, is a controlled hallucination. And when we share these controlled hallucinations, we call that reality. I hope I'm back. I'm so pleased that we've got through an hour and 24 minutes. That's the first dropping of the connection we've had. So so Marta, I hope that answers your question in some way. A question from Patrice. Can you speak to ways to find compassion for those we perceive as spreading hate and harm? I can. Everyone is striving. Everyone is craving safety, certainty, and security. And if that means, you know, literally, people are floundering around in puddles, ever shrinking puddles, like fish. That we feel that if we protect ourselves, if we protect our families, if we protect our tribes, that everything's going to be all right. And people fail to see that it's everyone's problem. If someone has COVID in India, that's my problem. If this vaccine's, you know, rotting away in freezers somewhere, that's just a waste. Universal healthcare should be universal healthcare. Everyone's health matters. But to see how people are frightened, how they fear for their own lives, their own sense of identity, if I can see that, if I can sense that, then at least I can step back and I can find some compassion for people who experience that fear. They, you know, hurt people hurt people. So it doesn't mean that I can engage with them often, you know, but I try to be polite or just step back and disengage, and certainly not to make matters worse by becoming, you know, embroiled in conflict. And certainly from the point of view of Brahma Viharas, then, you know, we can wish for these people, for people that don't that are spreading hate and harm and hurt people. You know, we can wish for them, you know, to find insight. Wish for them to be well. Wish for them to be safe. Wish for them to find peace of heart. Wish for them to stop hurting. And may they be free of pain and sorrow. I'm conscious of the time, and if there's another question, we might fit it into our session. But thank you. While we've still got a few minutes left, thank you all so much for sitting with me tonight and for putting up with any technical glitches. Thank you so much for your questions. Thank you for your practice. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for your presence. And for those offering dana, thank you for your thank you in advance for your dana. I will be offering a live face-to-face retreat in England next year, and as soon as other retreats come into the diary, I'll put them straight on the Hungry Ghost website. But I am open to, you know, I'm open to invitations to teach anywhere. You know, drop me a line and give me some details, and if I can work a mindful itinerary into offering teachings, you know, that's great. But also in the new year, starting in February, I'm offering the forgiveness program, a series of 6 2-hour programs looking at forgiveness, particularly on what have we got to lose. So all of those details will be on the Hungry Ghost website. As I said earlier, I'll post on the Hungry Ghost website the transcript of this talk, including the meditation and all the links to the references I made. So I'm very conscious of the time, Caroline. I'm not sure what the normal form is. Okay. Well, I make it 90 minutes now we've been together, or just under 90 minutes. I think we started late. So as I say, there's one more question. Let's see if I can answer it very, very quickly. Oh, thank you, Marta. Thank you. Oh, thank you for your question. Thank you for your blessings and blessings to everyone. Go well. And I hope to see you again at some point, online or face to face.